the greatest thing to me that I love is hearing the way that you honor the artist that you have on.
Stories make the world go round. They capture our minds, pull at our hearts, and inspire change, growth, and development.
It's just your genuine human appreciation on a deep, like, soul level for what artists do. This, your podcast is really dope.
I'm your host, Cello, and welcome to Bedroom Beethoven's, the podcast where we discover some of the preeminent music producers and entertainers of our time, and I turn them into storytellers.
What's up? This is J-Rock, and I'm right here. I'm chilling on the Bedroom Beethoven's podcast. That's what it is. Let's go.
Welcome, people of Earth. Episode 177 is here. My guest this week is...
My name is Marco Pave. I'm a hip-hop artist from Memphis, Tennessee, specifically North Memphis, Tennessee. Opened and shared the stage with tons of legends and greats. Mobb Deep, Young Dolph, Waka Flocka, Tech N9ne, Bilal, so many cool, eclectic type of people. So it's been a good time.
AKA Young Kano.
I know. Okay. Come through, Narwhal. I need at least 100,000. Spend it on my mama, gotta keep her smiling. When I was younger, I was wildin'. Around that fucking violence. Now my wife play fucking violin. So much money you can't count it. Nah, you niggas playing, but I'm balling. Gone. I'm out the hood, about to buy another home. I'm smoking good, about to cop another zone. Open the dispensary, what the fuck you won't get from me? 100K, that's a fucking starter pack. I just spit 10 grand on some starter caps. On guard, I never fuck with that hard.
Since 2013, Memphis hip-hop artist Marco Pave has forged a twin identity as a champion of independent Southern hip-hop and as an educator and arts advocate, working to stimulate community activism and entrepreneurship through the lens of hip-hop music and culture. We chat about growing up and being born and raised in North Memphis and how Pave started rapping seriously to articulate the dangerous day-to-day realities of his neighborhood. Now, being serious, it took a few years for him to align with his sense and purpose. And that's where I come in to curate a conversation that finds him Grammy-nominated in the very beginning of his 30s. It's built an unprecedented career that uses hip-hop culture not only as a means of personal expression, but also as an educational tool designed to make an impact on both individuals and systems of power. But before we get to all that, thanks for being here, and I welcome you into the new year. And as you dig into the show this week, I want to remind you that I have a Patreon set up at patreon.com/bedroombeethovens, and you could throw a few bucks to help keep the show ad-free and to show your support. And in turn, you get my thanks, early episodes, a few more perks, and more. Head on over to bedroombeethovens.com. There you can buy some merch. You can find older episodes if you need to. If you want to play catch-up, all that and more, I'm on all the socials except Facebook, so feel free to find me there as well. If you enjoy the show, tell a friend, and don't forget to rate and subscribe. A 5-star review is greatly appreciated, and liking the show just helps tip the algorithm in my favor. So let's get into it. Episode 177 with the great and powerful Marco Pave, from Texas to D.C. to Memphis, Tennessee. Let's get this show started. Well, I think the best way, you know, I'm going to Tarantino a little bit because, you know, starting at the end, because you're nominated for a Grammy Award for a project that shines a spotlight on 272 enslaved men, women, and children that were sold in 1838 by Georgetown University. And you know what? I want to have an honest conversation because I would think in the context of the college's reputation, they wouldn't want this information shared.
Mm-hmm. It's part of that energy in how they wanted to get out. So, you know, if you have questions specifically, we can get into it. But yeah, I'm ready to go on that one.
So you know, how much do you know of this backstory? Because the album talks about, well, I learned a lot with this project. Like in Georgetown, pertaining to enslaved and freed Africans, there's overrun burial sites where they unearthed in the DC area due to the city doing construction. They did a bunch of construction and then they found like teeth and skulls and limbs and in the walls of historic homes. And when I learned that, I immediately wondered, like, why were the remains not properly buried? Why were they put in walls of homes? I never heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, it goes deep. Like the Georgetown neighborhood itself was built, you know, by Black people, enslaved people. A lot of people don't know the history of Benjamin Banneker, the designer, the architect of DC. So the whole setup, how DC is, you know, set up on this grid where the streets run the way they run and all of that. Those were a black man's, you know, ideas, city making ideas. But he was also an enslaved man. The lack of care for these people is evident in that, you know, lack of burial for them. Because ironically enough, Georgetown has an actual graveyard on its campus where, you know, historical members of the institution are buried safely, properly, you know, on the campus. I mean, obviously they've stopped doing that, you know, in recent years, but the graveyard still stands, tombstones are still there and all of that.
And in those graveyards, they have unmarked graves for enslaved Black people, as well as marked graves of free Black people. And they are trying to improve the gravestones and they're trying to make the public history more accurate. And that university formed a 5-year partnership with the whole Southern University system. You know, they signed a memorandum of understanding, which I think is a good first step. And other universities even acknowledging that slavery even happened near or at these institutions. And just a few years ago, they set up a reconciliation fund that awards $400,000 to any community-based project that has a direct impact on communities whose ancestors were once enslaved. And I commend them for this. But these programs, they're new. They only started 6 years after Black Lives Matter formed. Why do you think it took so long for these type of initiatives to come to fruition? Why the slow progress?
I mean, yeah, you hit it on the head. You would think, you know, these institutions would want to hide this information. So given that that is the reality, given that is the truth of the shame around slavery, there's going to be some lackadaisical kind of energy when it comes to the real recognition, the real reconciliation that needs to be done. Like, you know, it's not that long ago. If we're looking at the numbers, if we're looking at, you know, time, like America is only 200 plus years. In that entire time, you know, slavery existed in that time. And so, yeah, the slow progress is just the unwillingness to deal with the true and deep ramifications of what slavery has wrought this country. It was built on the backs of free labor. Imagine if everyone that worked at Amazon worked for free, and Amazon pays people in high hundreds of thousands, the high millions, you know, CEOs making multi-millions of dollars, and it's still a $1 trillion company. So think about that. There were over 1 million slaves in America working for free. So that amount, the sheer amount of wealth that created and built, is something that institutions are afraid to reckon with. So they kind of spoon feed it and do it in the ways that they want to do it to make themselves feel better about this harsh reality.
Well, I think it's a good first step because, you know, I know they're trying to enhance their global reputation and I know we're in the infancy of it. But to put all of this in the context, these topics we're discussing, the last day of your 20s, mm-hmm. you got the nomination for the Grammy. That's a good footnote.
Yes, sir. It is.
Life everlasting.
Now, when you read the word slave in your false history books, you will know the truth. The so-called masters unknowingly elevated the souls of their property while simultaneously building a tomb in hell for themselves.
So So you know what you need to do now. So you released the Jordan mixtape at 23. Now at 30, you got to release the Pippen mixtape because he did wear 30 before he rocked 33.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know that. That's what's up. All right. Yeah. And yeah, shout out to Pippen too, because I feel like he's been kind of really shunned in these later years in his life. And it's like, you know, the story coming out about him, you know, Nike didn't want to give the up tempo to him as his signature shoe. And, you know, Jordan in the documentaries, like snubbing him. It's just, yeah, it's a lot of stuff. So shout out to Pimpin, man.
But your son being named Jordan, does that have anything to do with that?
It actually doesn't. I would say that. I mean, well, I guess I could say his mom maybe was more in alignment with that. She named him. So I let her, you know, do the naming duty, so that maybe for her it has something to do with it. But yeah, I just think it's a cool name.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the Islamic religion, if you grew up Muslim such as yourself, when it comes to baby names, they strongly encourage the adage of, you know, you shall be called by your names and the names of your father. So if you're, you know, Tahir Rahim the second, the faith would ideally want Jordan to be the third, or is that false?
I mean, I wouldn't say false. It's definitely, you know, Islam, like a lot of other religions, is patriarchal in nature. So yeah, that is kind of like expected. But for me, like, I want my son to have his own identity. Just like you don't have to be me, like, or you don't have to be the another version of me. Like, you be you, have your own name. And Jordan wanted his own name. So much so that, you know, I tell the story all the time. Like, he was supposed to be born a day before my birthday, November 15th, 2013. He said, you know what? I'm going to come a month early because I want my own month and my own birthday. I don't want to be associated with your birthday. So he came October 15th, 2013. So, yeah.
Full circle, though, because he's almost at the age, or no, he might have surpassed the age, but he's around the age when you first started rapping.
Oh, yeah. He's around that age. Yeah, he's 9. And so, yeah, I kind of got into it really seriously. Well, not seriously, but I got into it as a thing that I knew I wanted to do around 9 and 10 years old, for sure.
It's a very impressionable age. You know, when you rap at 8, 9, 10, you don't know your identity yet. So you have to emulate what you see, and you have to learn how to tell stories without pretending. You obviously know gangsters. You mm-hmm. obviously know killers, but you weren't one. So did you ever mm-hmm. want to be a product of the streets just so you could embody what you were rapping? Like, hey, if I'm a real life gangster, then maybe my raps will be better.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like, as far as like, that's the stuff that you're seeing, stuff that you're hearing. Like, I'm growing up in North Memphis. You know, my neighborhood is declining and businesses are closing. Friends are moving away. People are losing their homes. And all this stuff is happening in the context of my just early childhood. It was a lot of anger in that. And so my emulation was around trying to capture, you know, this frustrating feeling that I felt like, I don't know why we feel so overlooked and shunned in our community. I'm just 9 or 10. So I'm just a young person trying to figure out what my feelings are. And so the easiest feeling to go to for me at the time was towards the anger and towards the emulation of, you know, the gangster raps and things like that. But yeah, I definitely felt like you had to at least in some way be associated with the streets to, you know, make that be real.
So the first time that you performed for the whole school was around that time in sixth grade. Were your parents in the audience?
My parents were not in the audience. Yeah, this was just like a regular, like, school day kind of thing. And they took us all to the auditorium. And so this was at the time, too, was I was playing football. You know, I'm probably, bro, 85 pounds. If that 90 pounds or something crazy like that. I'm on a football team trying to, you know, chase this football dream that my dad, you know, was interested in. And so I knew like all these eighth graders and, you know, at the time, the eighth graders was like super big. Like these guys was like, I felt like they were like 15 or 16 or something. But yeah, when I got on that stage and was able to rap, like I felt, you know, way larger than life because it was like this small kid is finally getting the shine that I'm looking for. I don't want to be on the football field, you know, getting knocked around. I want to be on the stage in front of, you know, all of these people, letting them know what I really do. And that was like a big moment.
Yeah. And so unfortunately they didn't get to witness that big moment because that's where the seed was birthed.
Yeah.
You know, where like
Yeah,
I can do this. I mean, you know, your dad growing up, he had the sound system. You know, he almost laid the sonic influence for you to have a career in music. Your first recordings were on a tape player that you stole from his room, and yet it's hard to get his approval when you set that course for your life to be in music.
Exactly. That's what is so, like, fascinating. And this was just fascinating about families and stories and just, like, how things happen. Because the same similar things happened to my dad with his dad. My dad was a visual artist. Always did art. My dad went to the Memphis College of Art. He went there around the same time that Jimmy Carter's daughter was there. So he witnessed, like, the CIA and all these things coming in to protect her. And, you know, his dad kind of shunned his artist. So these years later, I'm being in a similar situation that my dad was in, and him kind of making the same kind of misstep, I would say, that his father did. It makes it an interesting story, and just, you know, a challenge for me to overcome.
The Grammy nomination, I'm sure, almost forced him to pay attention, though. Like, you know, what's the reaction when you get that nomination?
It's so funny, bro. Man, so, you know, like you said, it happened the day before my birthday, my 30th birthday. So, that's a reminder from the universe, or a gift from the universe, to say you did right in your 20s. So, yeah, he called me on my birthday and let me know happy birthday kind of deal. He didn't even know about the Grammys. And that, for some reason, something told me just don't share it in this moment. It's going to be not understood. The gravity of it is not going to be recognized if you share it in this call. So I was like, OK, cool, Dad. Thanks for the birthday. Blah, blah, blah. I'll be home in December. Doom, doom, doom. So he called me the next day because he was riding around town and he heard on the radio Marco Pave has been nominated for a Grammy on like multiple radio stations. So he called me immediately and I was in a meeting. And so he left a voicemail. So I checked the voicemail and he was like, I just heard on the radio. They said something about Marco Pave was nominated for a Grammy. Is that you? And I was just like, I'm just laughing exactly the way I am now, like when I heard the message and called him back and was like, of course, Dad, is me. Like, ain't no other Marco Pave like that in the world kind of deal. So but he was definitely blown away. And it kind of like made literally the last dozen years of my life make sense to him.
Yeah. And that's the thing, though, because like the Grammy is an outward appreciation that society can give you, but your story and your journey, your journey isn't just a testament to your talent and the passion, but I think it's an inspiration. And you can't be an inspiration to others without doing something worth being proud of, in my opinion. You know, if I'm a father to somebody, I don't know if I would be more proud that you're nominated for a Grammy or more proud for sticking with something for 25 years. It's like the age of 8 through dead end jobs, having a kid, realizing you wanted a better life for for his grandson. I would say those accomplishments almost overshadow the Grammy, but that's what it took for him. You know?
Hey, speak on it. You preach it. Hey, I'm gonna let you preach on that one, because that's how I feel, bro. Like, all of this stuff, like the Grammys is not nothing to me, but it's like you saying, like, I've been a community member. I've fought for students. I'm a mentor. I'm an activist. I'm you know, standing up against police. I'm, you know, fighting against gentrification. Like, all these things that I've done through rap have been just, you know, amazing feats that I know for sure that I'm proud of. Also, at the same time, I do understand his resistance towards that, because it's like everything happens so fast. So if I fast forward or rewind to 19 years old, I was on paper, you know, this destructive, you know, young man that seems lost in the world. And you fast forward, you know, to 22. I'm a married man. I got a baby. I'm doing TED Talks, and I'm just like, you know, all of these things. So it's like, whoa, this is a rapid succession. So kind of like he still probably got whiplash from how fast things changed for me.
Yeah. And the other half might be, you know, your family didn't come for money. They lived humbly. And if you approached them with a big dream, they might not be immediately invested. And I think that goes hand in hand when you live a life where, let's say, you have to wake up at 5:30 a.m. and you go to work every day to work a hard job so your kids can eat. And then your kids grow up and they say, I want to be a rapper. Maybe it can be a hard pill to swallow for them because they either didn't have dreams or they couldn't pursue them because they had a family. But I mean, if you sacrificed your dreams to work so your kids can grow up and chase their dreams, that should be the goal. And you just so happen to live in the city that has produced the most self-made mm-hmm. artists. You have tangible examples between Young Buck, DJ Paul, Yo Gotti, that you can excel mm-hmm. in the music game.
And I grew up seeing these guys. We're talking about, you know, 3-6 Mafia. They're from the same neighborhood as me. You know, they went to the same high school that my father went to. Northside High School, Juicy J, Jordan Houston. He's a Northside High graduate, just like my father. You know, Project Pat. Those are brothers. Patrick Houston. They brothers. Growing up in my neighborhood, Yo Gotti. I used to see him ride around town 04-05 with a truck with his face on it. That's how they used to promote themselves. With heavy promo. So I was surrounded by these guys who were about to take the world by storm. So it was no way that I wouldn't want to be a part of that. But you touched on something that was, you know, important. Like, yeah, my dad, you know, it was four of us. And my mom was not in the picture because of mental health issues. And so he was kind of on his own raising us. And then, yeah, he had this, he worked in sales for a long time. But then, you know, the recession came pre-recession. He started working in FedEx, which became the huge staple, you know, in my family. Like, everybody worked at FedEx, all my sisters. I didn't. I kind of avoided that because I didn't want to do it. And that even caused tension in my family. So it was, yeah.
And I think, you know, moments like, you know, you go to a music video, you saw him around town. Finally, he's outside of like Watkins Market. I can just picture 40 dudes with chains rapping in front of this market. And off to the sidewalk is this 11-year-old kid watching with wide eyes, being inspired to be mm-hmm. the next generation. And that kind of trips me out.
Absolutely. And it just, we saw it. Like, you literally, these are neighborhood superstars, neighborhood heroes, like, come from the same blocks that we both roamed on at one point. Like you said, I'm 11, he's a grown man, but we're still, you know, taking up the same space or occupying the same space. Which is powerful.
Were you able to go up to 8 Ball or Yo Gotti or anybody during that shoot and just be like, you know, get some advice, some mentorship, some recognition, or you just showed up?
Nah. Yeah, I just kind of showed up. I was scared. I just kind of showed up. It was just, that was enough for me to just see it.
But around that time, you know, you're still in grade school, even, you know, in the environment you live up, even with all that violence, crime and turmoil, you still came to school draped up and dripped out, Pave Diamonds, the whole nine. Nobody punched you in the face, attempted to steal that in the hallways. You weren't scared?
Well, no. See, I ain't started the Pave vibe until high school. So, yeah, middle school, I still was kind of like on the struggle bus of like figuring myself out, you know, getting bullied here and there. Teeter-tottering between joining the gang for protection kind of deal, and pretty much, you know, made the choice to, you know, join to be protected and be around, you know, the camaraderie of a crew kind of deal. But then, you know, academically I excelled. And so I'm gonna tell this story real quick. So I went to Valentine Elementary. Valentine Elementary was an optional school. Optional school really just means like it's the better version of a public school. That's the quick way I can put it. All of my family went there. I went there. But the sister that's closest to me in age, all my other sisters went to this middle school called Snowden. Snowden was another optional school. That's like the best middle school you can go to. It's diverse. It's, you know, white people, Asian people going there, da 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 da. So my sister that's closest to me, she ended up getting kicked out of Snowden and went to Cypress Middle, which is like, that is not the school to go to if you, you know, want your kids to make it to see something. And then I never got a chance to go to Snowden at all. I went straight to Cypress because they had did the redistricting. So my district was now zoned for Cypress. So I went to Cypress with I'm 2 miles away from my neighborhood. You know, I'm in the Hollywood Hyde Park area. You got all the Crips and all of that over there. So I'm every day like traversing into a different neighborhood. But then, like I said, back to the part of academically excelling. So in seventh grade, I took the test called the TCAP, which was like a standardized test, and I was advanced in every category. So they basically came in the classroom and took me out of the, you know, regular class that I was in and was like, look, you got to take all these honors classes and be with all the honors kids from this moment forward. And so basically when I started eighth grade, I was in like a whole different kind of environment academically. So all the gang members and all the like hood kids that I was with, I couldn't be with them no more. And I had to be with the, you know what I'm saying, the honor students. So I traversed like all of these different lanes when I was in middle school to help prepare me for high school.
And that carried over in the high school because maybe Nas had an impression on you because you have the world is yours.
That was I just was trying to, I bought the first thing that I thought was cool. That's really what that was. And so, yeah, the Marco Pave probably came, I would say 11th grade, because as you pointed out, I was young Kano. And then, yeah, I got into this jewelry phase, influenced more so by Soulja Boy with the long chains and the big medallions and things like that. And so, yeah, then my friend was like telling me about Micro Pave. Micro Pave is a diamond setting. And so he was like, man, you should call yourself that. That should be your name. And so I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to say Kano Marco Pave. That was my entire ridiculous rap name for a while. I dropped the Kano off and then just became Marco Pave, and it stuck ever since.
And then you're making five figures by 12th grade, and that ain't from salt and french fries, I assume. So
it was a little bit of both, but definitely my McDonald's job was not, you know, friendly towards a young person. You know, this was a moment where, you know, we coming out of not even coming out, we're going into the recession. So like a lot of my coworkers were 25, 26, 30, you know, these people need the real hours. And I got this job when minimum wage was $6.55. It had just transitioned in that June or July to $7.25, which where it still stands today in Memphis. That was almost 13, 14 years ago. Yeah, so the McDonald's job was not a good one for me. I made really no money and got fired from eating McDonald's on the job, on the clock. then my next job was Kroger. I was a bagger doing that. And then, yeah, me and friends of mine, we got started to get involved in, you know, some baby level organized crime. And it kind of... it helped pay for senior dues. It helped pay for car repairs and, you know, things that the job couldn't help me do.
Where does the interest in IT come from? Because when you're at Southwest Tennessee, was it just something you picked and like, man, I'll just see what happens? Or was there actually like, I have an interest in this field?
It's kind of like just see what happens, because it was like, you know, influence or what they tried to push young men at the time is just, you know, IT or either a trade or, you know, so that kind of influence was on me. So I was like, maybe, you know, I grew up working on computers or grew up recording myself on these, you know, old IBM computers. And so it was just something that I felt like would have been like a right decision for me. But school just wasn't it. But also it was less about school being it and more about the economic status that I had as a young person at that time. Like, you know, I get my grant check and I needed to spend that grant check on getting a car, because I needed to get a car to get to school because Memphis doesn't have any adequate public transportation. And so it's like, if you don't have a car, you got to choose between going to work and making money that like everybody wants you to do, or getting to school and not having a job. So it was like I had to choose the job, And so eventually, yeah, I had to drop out. My grades started to slip and, you know, I had to make a choice on what I, you know, wanted to do or how I was going to choose to survive in that moment.
You're welcome. Yeah. Hey, this I am the story, nigga. Huh? Yeah. I can show you how to cook right. Can I show you what a millionaire look like? Hey, let me show you how to
And then this is where it gets interesting because you drop out due to those circumstances you just named. Yo Gotti drops the I Am album right when you drop out of college. And you know what's funny is Metro Boomin is the same age as you when you drop out when he got placement on that album. He was 19. Ooh. So did that album motivate you to go harder?
Oh, yeah, I would definitely say that was like the rise. You starting to see like Yo Gotti like, oh, no, he's starting to get distinguished. Like this is something different. Like his energy is different. He bossing up, like he's becoming, you know, Jeezy level. He's becoming, you know, Rick Ross level, Southern, you know, ambassador, Southern boss kind of vibe. So yeah, that was definitely a big influence, a big motivation, but also at the same time, I was stuck. I was, you know, dropping out wasn't like a shoe-in to doing something better necessarily. I was still working dead-end jobs and still just trying to, you know, figure my life out. I think I had shortly after dropping out, went to get my forklift license, which is, you know, Memphis's distribution capital of the world. Next to Beijing, China. And so that's going to be a heavy, you know, industry in our community. So yeah, I got my forklift license and tried to go after these jobs where I'll be making like $13-14, you know, dollars an hour, and kind of did that for a while until I, you know, got burnt out from 12-hour shifts and ruining my sleep schedule. And yeah.
You're not the first person to tell me that, because TM88 was like, man, they groom you just to go work at the chicken factory. I mean, that's Memphis. Yeah. That's crazy. Yep. And you know, you're working security, you're stealing cigarettes, you're selling drugs at 20. You got depression, you're at the clubs wilding out, you got anxiety, you're bagging groceries, you got a newborn. Can you boil all this down to the lowest terms? That shift in your mindset to one defining moment, the epiphany, where you changed your life and you're on a TED Talk stage less than 2 years later.
Ooh, wee. I feel like the real epiphany, my first epiphany came when going into 11th grade over the summer, playing with the gun with a friend of mine and like the gun jamming, you know, long story short, the gun jam when he pulled the trigger. And that was like the eye opening moment. Because it was like, nah, I got to get it together. So for me, I'm always like I never do something for too long. Even when I, you know, messed around with selling drugs or whatever, I didn't do it for too long. I'm like, no, this is not the final step for me. I'm going to do this to see, I'm going to do this to experience, but I'm moving on from that. And so I said that to say like that moment, like really opened up my eyes. And so when that happened, I had a 1.8 GPA in high school. And then I went after that moment, I went and got myself into honors classes. I went and got myself into all AP classes because I was just like, look, God told me to stay alive. And I got to pursue. So I end up, you know, graduating high school with I needed a 3.0 to get the scholarship that I needed. I had a 2.99. And it was like, whoa, that was like eye opening thing. Cause it's like, man, you can't mess around. You mess around for, you know, ninth grade and part of 10th grade. And now your high school career is essentially ruined for decisions that you made. And so I had to stick with that and sit with that, you know, but that sheer tenacity that I had for schoolwork, I started to turn that towards my music. And so it was like I had already had my awakening. It was just like I knew I wanted to do something more than working these jobs and struggling and being around the energy that was draining. And so, yeah, I think my last moment working the job was 2013. My son was 2 months old. I was working a seasonal job at Williams-Sonoma forklift. And once that seasonal job was over, I told myself I'm never, ever working a job again. And I'm going to figure this music out. And yeah, here we are.
But you need help from people though. Like, you didn't have a job and you weren't in school. How do you go from disconnected youth to releasing an opera in a year's time? I would imagine that there's a fair amount of convincing people that you're serious too.
Oh yeah, for sure. It was absolutely in the midst of all of that. Like, I was doing stuff already, like working my dead end job. I had already got the attention of the city to write a song about blight in the community. So the mayor's office reached out to me. I'm like 19 years old, writing a song about blighted communities and utilizing my voice. And, you know, so I was on my way. It wasn't like I was just like sitting around waiting on somebody to help me do something. It was like I was showing my prowess with my talent, but the economic standing was so strong and so overpowering that took precedent over my accomplishments. It was like, you know, you ain't making no money off of that, you know, song you did for the mayor. You ain't, you know what I'm saying, making no money off these little interviews that you getting. But at the same time, I was building my career. People knew me as Marco Pave. People knew me as a local artist. And so that meant something to me. And so, yeah, the help definitely started to come once I let go of this baggage of a dead end job and made this decision to say, hey, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to find a way to do what I want to do. And God opened up those platforms for that to happen.
What's the success rate of like the cold approach where like, You email like, hey, I'm 18, I'm local, I want to perform at this venue, here are a few of my songs, I hope you like it. Like, if you have, that might have worked for you, but if you have dreams of working with Timbaland, Ninth Wonder, and Just Blaze, can you email them the same way? Like, hey, you're a legendary producer, here are a few of my raps, hope to hear from you.
I mean, you could. I feel like nowadays that's less of an approach, unless you like are a really good emailer.
It's how you and I connected. It works sometimes.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, and you know that's what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to have a conversation where people can learn from. And I think the hardest roadblock is your notion of, you know, you don't have to be a practitioner of hip hop to learn from hip hop. Whereas I know university professors who use hip hop as a bridge to connect with students. And that seems to be the thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Because you, before you came along, and I know this to be true because the director of the Georgetown music program said it himself, but it's always been jazz and blues, Stax Records. You know, you have this dominant cultural force called hip hop, and they've never, ever leaned into it in the last 40 years. So now you're a part of a program in its infancy. How do you get freshmen who may have never been exposed to the medium to learn from hip hop?
I mean, I would say like, you know, they have been like, I would say they're surrounded by it. They're inundated by it. Look, you can't tell me somebody that's 18 right now that's on TikTok, they're not being beat over the head with hip hop culture. The problem is that it's like you're saying, it's not being implemented into the curriculum, or it's not being implemented or recognized and celebrated from the, you know, institutional level. But they're surrounded by it. They see it every day. It's the influence in all the young kids all over the world to dress like, you know, young black people and act like young black people, speaking like it's the culture, or, you know, the words that we use all coming from, you know, this hip hop culture. So it's important to like think about what's happening and how this stuff is being produced and who's in charge and how are artists being compensated for their contributions. And those are the things that are important to like be studying while we're, you know, in school, because either you're going to talk about it in school or you're going to see it every single day when you are on your phone or scrolling through the TV kind of deal.
And I was also thinking it from like maybe a race standpoint, you know, like I remember how the University of Memphis did your wife, man. And that was messed up because you would think that that's something that would happen in the 90s, not a few years ago. You know, it's before hip hop residencies and university slavery recognitions. Just a few years ago, if you said that white college males are a problem as a black person, you can get fired for that. You know, we've made a lot of progress in the last few years. And I believe that it starts with Georgetown U. And I think that you and your wife, all you guys, are exactly where you're supposed to be, making the change that will have the biggest impact 5 years from now. I think you guys are in the right place.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It definitely was an unfortunate, you know, moment. Like my wife truly spoke about just a simple thing, like whiteness being terror. And she was tried to be crucified for that. And she absolutely, you know, actually wasn't fired. They didn't fire her. She had already taken another job at another college in Memphis. But they wanted to frame it as they fired her for her statements to make themselves look, you know, bold to the white supremacist right-wing media, which was kind of insane. And we had police escorts, you know, for about 2 weeks, watching our house, and because, you know, death threats and rape threats and all type of crazy stuff was coming to us. Yeah, just like you said, just a few years ago, this was 2015. So we spent the first year of our marriage, you know, going through, you know, this. So yeah, it was wild. And you know, Georgetown has its own work to do as well. It's a very, you know, white institution, and yeah, it has a lot of work, but making progress is definitely better than, you know, being a part of the problem, for sure.
So in present day, in 2022, going into 2023, have the expectations of a young black boy from North Memphis improved?
I'm gonna say no, because you know, I come from a different generation. I come from this last generation. You know, I had my first 3 or 4 years into, you know, grade school, primary school, was not a part of the No Child Left Behind regime. All kids after that, or all kids born into the No Child Left Behind regime, had their whole schooling, you know, through that regime. And it's, you know, based on like just pushing through students through. It's based on testing. It's based on, you know, taking music out of the schools. It's based on like all of these things. And so yeah, the city school system or county school system that's in Memphis is very lackadaisical. Well, no, that's not the right word. It's very detrimental to young black people. It lacks care. And so the place that you spend the most of your time at being detrimental to your, you know, well-being is a problem. So the outlook for young black people in Memphis, North Memphis specifically, is kind of more bleak than it was when I was coming up, if I'm gonna be really honest.
Well, I live in Houston right now, and Snooty Wild, he died in Houston. He was found in a ditch with gunshot wounds to his neck. He left behind 4 children. Young Dolph, everybody knows that story, shot 22 times. Another Memphis rapper was shot in Houston in September, a lot of cash. And in August, Memphis rapper Princess Loco died as well. So normally this question would seem a bit vanilla, a bit cliche, but you do so much community work that I think you could give a real take on it. First off, why is Memphis such a hub for violence, and what needs to change in the community? For instance, if I'm Yo Gotti and I'm successful, does Memphis boost me up, or will my city not support me? Will I have haters? Will all my high school friends expect me to boost their careers? And if I don't, will they hate me? If you, Marco, you know, if you forget about all the people that you came up with, do you have to look over your shoulder? Like, oh, this guy can make an opera, but he can't buy my family a turkey on Thanksgiving. You know, Young Dolph went to a bakery to get cookies for his mom and he got shot. So I know you love your city, but please, you know, maybe shed light on some of these topics.
Yeah, man, it's, you know, things are not as black and white as they seem. But I like to start with it's all the economics of it. You know, I like to start at the fact that, you know, minimum wage in Memphis, Tennessee, in the year of our Lord 2022, is $7.25. You know, that's a huge part of what's going on. And on top of that, the average rents are now, you know, $1,100 a month for a 1-bedroom apartment. Unheard of in Memphis. So you got rapid gentrification happening with the exploitation of a black workforce, because Memphis is a 65% black city. There are no economic opportunities. I spoke on the schools already being detrimental to the young people. They treat them like they're in prison. They treat them like they don't matter. You have this cycle of abuse happening over and over and over. There's no surprise. To be honest, let me be real. I'm surprised there's not more violence in a city like Memphis because of the conditions. If you have to live here or experience and see like how detrimental and downtrodden and the system of oppression is just blanketed over the city. And so, yeah, all of those things kind of like are a part of the reason why Memphis is, you know, violent in that way. But even in at the same breath, like, you could go places without being harmed. You can go do things without being harmed. It's not, you know, the Wild Wild West, but it is some reckoning that needs to happen from city government, from the schools, and just more care for the community should be had to, you know, combat a lot of this feeling of being forgotten. Like, Memphis feels like a forgotten city.
Yeah, the producer Drumma Boy came on my podcast and told me that he couldn't do anything in Memphis. He said the best thing that he could do was go to Atlanta, blow up there, and funnel money back to Memphis. And I think that that's a big problem too, where people are, they feel like they can't do anything in their city and they have to go to Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real thing. Like, even for me, I was the biggest advocate. I still am the biggest advocate of Memphis and the things, but I seen it all from I seen how the sausages was made. I seen the billionaires that control this city. I seen the billionaires that say, hey, I don't want this to be funded. We're not doing that. Or this funding that I did give to schools, I'm taking that away because I just don't want to do it anymore. Like, I seen a real control, the real power that this city has. And if you don't know nothing about that and you just are a regular person trying to make it happen in Memphis, like, it's an impossible battle to go up against. Like, even for me, I would not be Grammy nominated if I hadn't, you know, moved to DC and accepted this role as artist in residence and, you know, all of these things like that. I love Memphis, but it's certain things that don't happen for individuals because there's no infrastructure and support for those things to be done.
Would it be a Herculean effort to make like an album dedicated to Memphis? What if you had Verghost, John Waltz, Xavier Wolf, Sincere to Misfit, MJG, Zane Rigo, Scooby, 8-Ball, Kingpin, Skinny Pimp, Hippie Soul, Young Buck, Tay the Pearl, Black Youngsta, you know what I mean? Just have an album called Memphis and get the whole damn block on it, like what, like Big Sean or Apollo Brown did for Detroit, you know? Would that even be worth it?
Man, I mean, it definitely would be worth it. It is the, you know, will the effort of, you know, one man, will it kill that man to do all of that?
Probably.
To do all that organizing and agonizing over schedules and getting people together. But all of those names you named are just legendary people, just amazing people to the community. But I do think what is important is telling the story of all of these guys, whether it be documentaries, whether it be autobiographies. Like, we just need more media to come out about, you know, less about the music and more about the stories and paths that have already been set. And we need to, you know, have more people telling their own stories and things, being proud of what they've contributed to the culture.
Yeah, here's my thing, man. You got this this black boy from North Memphis with a dollar and a dream who is now nominated with a 91-year-old lady named Sophia. I'm going to butcher her last name, but she is considered one of the foremost Russian composers of the second half of the 20th century. And if you beat an international figure who was born in 1931, man, I think that alone, no disrespect to Sophia, but I think a win for you over a figure like that, it just ushers in a whole new era for that category.
I think so, for sure. Like I said, you could fact check it, but I think I'm the first rapper nominated in that category. And you know, we had to do some finagling and finessing because they didn't want it to recognize it in that way. But you know, the category that they nominated us in is Best Contemporary Classical Composition. And, you know, if you take me off of this record, there is no composition. There is music, but that doesn't tell the story of the Requiem for the Enslaved. And that's important. And so they had to recognize that and say, hey, this person is the librettist. This person is also a composer on this project. And that's how we, you know, I got my nomination as well.
If you win a Grammy, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go out and buy a 1996 T-top Camaro, but don't buy one. Don't buy one for $1,500. You got to buy one, restore it, and get it on that daily driver level. And the Camaro that ruined your college life is now it's glowing on your driveway. That's how you do it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm definitely, that's been a goal. That's a goal. The 96 T-top Camaro. a 92 5.0, like, yeah, I'm gonna, you know, get my car collection together soon. So yeah, definitely want to do that.
There you go, man. All right, I want to give you the floor, man. Tell the people the Marco Pave plans for 2023.
Oh man, yeah, we got a lot of stuff planned. You know, we got a new project dropping at the top of the year, before the Grammys are announced and all of that. So you see, I've been just dropping singles after single. And so, yeah, it's time to like put those singles into a body of work that can be discussed and talked about. So that's happening. We'll be touring opportunities and touring for the Requiem for the Enslaved, you know, going to different fine arts venues around the country, performing arts venues around the country to really take this story on the road, to reach the people that need to be reached. So I'm super excited about that, touring in that way. It's going to be really fun because performing for like orchestral arrangements and, you know, these different types of settings is super fun and invigorating. And it's less of the hassle of like club performances and, you know, being on the road with people getting drunk and partying and all of that. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, I branched out into screenwriting. I've been doing that for like the past 3 or 4 years, and I have some super cool projects in the works. Speaking of Skinny Pimp, he's going to be narrating one of these projects that I'm working on. I can't say too much, but it's coming in the near future. So yeah, I'm excited to be branching into this producing world and screenwriting world, and excited to write more stuff and bring more stuff to market.
There you go, man. I appreciate you allowing me to put some shine on Memphis and for highlighting your work in DC and giving me an hour of your time, man. I really do appreciate it.
No, absolutely. Like, you are really good at what you do, and the research is impeccable. And yeah, it's a good conversation to be able to just like explore your own journey and shine light on that. And hopefully there are gems in this, my story, to help other people in their journey.